You're listening to the Deal Farm Podcast with Ken Corsini. Educating, inspiring, and connecting you to real estate deals. And now, your host, Ken Corsini.
Hey, this is Ken Corsini with The Deal Farm. On today's Best Deal Ever episode, I've got Chad Carson. Chad, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Ken. How about you?
Very good. Thanks for being on the show, man. I appreciate it.
Yeah, great to be here. Thanks for asking me.
So Chad is out of Clemson, South Carolina. He's actually a former football player, actually captain of the defense. He was a linebacker, actually was in school same time I was in school back in the late 90s, early 2000s. He's a full-time real estate investor now. He's also a writer. He's got a very popular newsletter at CoachCarson.com. But I'm curious, I'd love to hear the story, Chad. How did you go from being a football player at Clemson to being a full-time real estate investor?
Yeah, sort of a funny story, Ken. I had some kind of aspirations of going to the NFL. It was not my dream growing up, but you know, I did pretty well in college. Was a linebacker and was training with scouts and doing all that. And long story short, it sort of deflated. I fell off a cliff, so to speak, where I didn't make it in the NFL, and I didn't want to go play Canadian ball. And so, I mean, I was sort of like anybody who's either getting out of school, whether it's high school, college, you're sort of figuring out what you want to do with your life. Mm-hmm. And I had sort of that fork in the road where I was a biology major. So a lot of people went into medical school, and I took my MCAT and started applying to medical schools. Mm-hmm. I was also, was fortunate. I was getting recruited by some like investment banks up in Wall Street. They looked at a lot of like deep, high performing college athletes and academic kind of people who could do athletics and academics. And they recruited some of them, I guess, just for the high stress environment and performance. And So I was kind of looking, I was like, all right, well, medical school, that route, which is a, you know, one path where you're in it for a long time, or, you know, work the corporate world somehow. But then I had this third option, which was intriguing. It was sort of a little bit crazy, was, well, why don't you just start your own business and go in and start. And I knew real estate because my father had some rental properties, and I used to do a little bit with that and clean them up over Christmas break and that kind of thing. And I read a book on a shelf and said, you know what, this sounds crazy, but I'm just going to start my own business, and I'm going to try to learn how to buy and sell real estate, eventually own it. And I think the big motivation for me, and this is always a big theme for me, was, you know, those other paths almost felt like confining, you know, for a lot of entrepreneurs feel like they have to be flexible and be able to do their own thing. And for me, that's what it was. It was, you know, those are great paths, and they're good jobs. And I think I would have been interested in it, but I was really drawn by the flexibility and the freedom and the lifestyle potential. It's just unlimited on how you could build it and what you can do with being an entrepreneur. And so it was sort of to set the sights on kind of financial independence and building a unique life where I work out of my house and can travel and be flexible. And that's where it sort of drew me in that way. And I just jumped in, and I didn't have a lot to lose. I didn't have a lot to lose. I owned my car free and clear. I didn't have any college debt because I got a college scholarship, luckily.
Nice.
And I had $1,000 in the bank, and I said, all right, let's learn how to do this thing.
What did your parents say when you said, yeah, I just got this great biology degree, and I'm not going to do anything with it?
Yeah, they're actually pretty supportive. My father, you know, very fortunate again, because both of them were entrepreneurial minded, and maybe that's what pushed me that way. But my mom is a dentist and owned her own practice, and my father is a real estate investor and is kind of a serial entrepreneur. He did different things. So I think both of them were very supportive of it. And
yeah.
In fact, that's how you always need mentors. And I went back to work in my hometown for 1 year to learn the business. And that's how I got started, was basically assigning deals to, it happened to be my father in this case, but it could have been any investor who's a landlord and had some money in a town who was looking to buy deals. I just figured out, I said, well, what's your formula? Tell me the locations and the formula. And I would go out and hustle and just try to find him deals. And I would make a little bit of a small assignment fee every time I found a deal for him. And so that was really, I was able to learn the business. I was able to live cheap. I was able to make, you know, it took me 6 months actually to find the first deal for him. So, I mean, I was full time every day knocking on doors, sending letters, doing stuff, which I don't think a lot of people realize sometimes how long it can take to get it ramped up, especially if you're doing it part time. And it took me 6 months to actually get him a deal. And but then from there, it really ramped up, and I did 12 deals in the next 6 months. And was off and running from there.
You know, it's so funny. This is such a common theme that I've had with other guests, is that when they first get started, it takes a very long time to get that first deal under their belt for whatever reason. It's probably just them figuring out how to do it and do it well. But then once you get that first deal, it's like then the floodgates sort of open up and you've got it figured out and you get in a groove and you start getting more deals. But there's definitely something to be said about being patient and having some fortitude to stick it out till you get that first deal.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, part of it might be psychological. Part of it might just be that idea that you need to build up your muscles. You know, like if you were to go out and train, let's go into athletics. You know, if you're going to train and play football or basketball or something, you can't just run out there and play, get in game shape overnight.
That's right.
You've really got to build up. And there's so many little things that we don't even realize we're learning when we're in that stage. And so, yeah, I think I'm with you. I think the most difficult stage to get through is that first deal and then getting over that hump. And it just from there, it's not that it's easy all the way, but I think you're positive about it. You believe it can be done and then you start continuing to learn, but you've got that momentum and that confidence from that first deal.
Yeah. And then you also start making contacts in the area you're operating in, and deals start kind of finding their way to you. And even a lot of the original marketing that you do, so much of that marketing will come back in the form of follow-up. You may not get it on that first go-round, but those deals, you know, 3-4 months later, those sellers will find their way back to you. And
exactly.
So you're really building a pipeline without realizing it.
That's right. Yeah, it takes a while. And that networking is key. I agree that you can't, you know, a big part of my core business strategy, both for finding deals and for getting money and for selling properties and renting properties, has been about those personal relationships. Mm-hmm. And I'm in a small town in Clemson, and I think everywhere you live is a small town. Even if you're in a big city, you know, you run in little circles of people, and people make everything happen. And so, you know, it takes a long time to build trust with people. You can use marketing techniques, and that's great. And you can have the best direct mail strategy, and those are all important. But at some point, it comes down to, you know, if you've been in business for 3, 4, 5 years and you're not getting a ton of referral business from existing people who know you and have a relationship, then something's wrong. You know, that's the way most people in a small town do business. The local attorneys, the local financial planner, the hair salon, you know, everybody, they advertise a little bit, but it's more about people knowing what you do, knowing that you perform, knowing that you're trustworthy. Mm-hmm. And it just really kind of, as we're talking about catapult, you know, just kind of waterfalls from there, and it gets better and better.
Absolutely. Yeah, the more you're in it, the more you're really investing in yourself by creating those relationships, because eventually it snowballs and it does pay off in a big way. You know, the other thing to note too is you got your start the way I tell so many new investors to start, especially you coming out of college. You didn't really have, you hadn't built up a bank account yet, but assigning and wholesaling is the perfect way to just get your feet wet and start, you know, getting a paycheck through real estate. Because what were you probably putting up bandit signs and passing out cards and probably posting on Craigslist?
I did the whole gamut. You know, I went to the seminars and said, I think I heard somebody say, I'm not like a real outspoken person, so doing the marketing was tough for me. Mm-hmm. But I heard somebody at a seminar say, if you're not embarrassed by putting the word out there about your business, you're not doing it right.
That's good.
You know, you got it. And so I started looking at everything. I said, you know what? This is my survival. If I don't market and tell people what I'm doing, I'm going to be out of business. And so I put the whole thing, you know, actually I was dating a girl at the time, and I came back one day and I had my car, my Toyota Camry that I had since I was 16 years old, wrapped in like We Buy Houses, you know, vinyl all over it. And it was
nice.
Like, look at it, it was only $200 and I got my whole car, you know, wrapped. And needless to say, that relationship didn't work out long run, but
she didn't want to go on dates in the wrapped
car.
Yeah,
no more dates in that one. So, but I did buy a house a year for like 5 years off of that. And each one I made a minimum of like, you know, $5,000-$10,000 on it. And
wow.
So it's like, all right, the numbers are like just ridiculous on signs and ads and how much money you make off of them. It's more about the, you know, are you willing to do what it takes to make it happen? And that was what it was for me. I was wholesaling. I said, I have to make these deals work. I've got to be better than everybody else at finding the good deals. And so what competitive advantage can I have? It's just being bold, and I'm young, and I'll go out and hustle, and I'll do whatever I got to take, whatever it takes. And that's a big part of it.
Especially being young and having all that energy and being a go-getter and making it happen. So talk to us about, after you had some success assigning deals to your dad in Noonan, you probably put some money in your bank account. You're like, okay, now I want to move back to Clemson. How did that evolve for you?
Yeah, it was sort of one of those things. We both knew it was a short term, and I, you know, I went to school at Clemson. It's a small town. It's in a little bit slower pace of life, but I still feel like I'm an Atlanta native. So I'm, you know, I like the sports teams, but it was just far enough where I could sort of do my own thing and get in a smaller town. And so I moved back up there, and I'd had a friend from college who also had some family real estate experience, and we decided to go into business together. He had another business on the side, but we went into business together, and the natural evolution for us was to start, instead of us assigning the deal to somebody else and letting them make all the profit, why not, we could assign a few, but why not find the way to get the money and then flip it ourselves? And so we got into the flipping business, and up in Clemson, South Carolina. And in that first year, we did 3 deals that we flipped. You know, some of them were short sales, like pre-foreclosure kind of stuff. Another one was a REO, like a post-foreclosure we bought from a bank. And so we just got in the rehabbing business of buying them, fixing them, and then turning around and reselling them. And that was just the way we paid. You know, it's all about paying the bills for a while. So the first year was just paying the bills and saving up a little bit of cash. The second year was, you know, we didn't make any money on those flips until the second half of the year once we got them sold. So it was just, you know, really low overhead to get this thing working out of the house to try to get the thing off the ground. But by the end of that second year, you know, we were had a little bit of cash in the bank and continued flipping, but we started getting our sights on long-term what our goal was. And that was, we want to ramp this up and do more and also start buying some income properties, some rental properties. And so we started figuring out ways to do that. And for me, you know, I was I didn't have a job. I didn't have a real job. You know, when I go to the bank and say, hey, I'm flipping some houses, I'm 23 years old. How does that sound for giving me a loan?
Yeah.
You know, that's not the most positive loan application they're going to look at. Although I did have some bank relationships. And so what we had to do was getting more into the alternative financing. So using seller financing, using self-directed IRAs of people that we met, other investors, local friends, people like that. And so almost all of our deals were put together with that kind of financing, both our flips and our buy and hold type stuff. We would put together private financing to do our deals. And that when we finally started doing that, that's what really took it sort of to the next level for us. We could start doing more deal volume and more growth, and that was really a big change for us.
You mentioned you had a partner. Are you guys still partnered together, or did you guys end up parting ways at some point?
No, we are. Yeah, we're still great. And a lot of people, you know, I've talked to other people about that. They ask, should I get into a partnership? Should I not? And, you know, I've heard stats about a lot of partnerships don't work. But for us, at least, it's worked really, really well. And part of it was personality. You know, we just had similar work ethics, similar goals, similar values. But the other part was, I think we did a pretty good job. We reread the book, the E-Myth. Like at the very beginning of our career. And in that book, it talked about taking, like, even though you're a tiny little business working out of your living room, take the entire, all the systems of your business and like build an org chart, like organization chart, like you would in a corporation, and say one person's the CFO, one person's the bookkeeper, one person's the sales coordinator, one person's the acquisition person. And we basically had like 15 positions that we outlined on this little piece of paper. And I said, all right, which one do you want to be, Tommy? Which one do you want to be, Chad? And we kind of like, we were all those different positions. But the thing that we didn't realize how good that was it divided up the business and said, I'm responsible for this. You're responsible for this. And the way it turned out was I was the acquisitions person. I was the financing person going out and finding the money. And as soon as we bought the property, he took it over and he managed the rehab and the contractors. And then he managed getting, whether we sold it ourselves or rented it or had a realtor, he would coordinate getting it liquidated or farmed out. And so we had a good, you know, we were able to kind of divide and conquer and have a purpose for having that partnership. Because if it would have just been, hey, we're in business together, this is great, this is happy, you know, a lot of those don't work out because there's not a real, you know, why are you in business together? Is there any reason for doing that? I mean, it either needs to be like one person brings the money, one person brings the work and the expertise, or having some other kind of reason for doing that. And, you know, our reasons have evolved over time to the point where I'm a little bit more active in the business now. He's more passive and has another business that's doing well. And so, it can evolve, but I think that principle stays the same, that if you don't define your partnership and why you're in business together pretty early on and continue to do that, I think that's typically when the problems happen.
Yeah. Well, if you guys you mesh well with personalities, you have a similar work ethic, that makes things a lot easier. A lot of people get into partnerships with people they don't know that well, or maybe they're just blind to the fact they don't mesh that well, and that's when you run into trouble. But that's awesome. You guys have been able to stay partners this long, and things have gone well. So even your rental portfolio, is that owned jointly as well?
Yeah, exactly. It's all 50-50. You know, I've got a couple little deals on the side, like a principal residence that I moved out of and rented out afterwards. And so, you know, we've got a little bit individually, but yeah, it's just worked out well for us. And, you know, the other thing that's been sort of a wild card for me that I didn't realize early on was as we started ramping up and we were doing a lot of volume and we brought on some team members and we had sort of a decision point in our life to where we said, well, you know, what are we trying to get really big? And that's great, you know, that could be fun to do it. But we started looking in the mirror and saying, you know, why are we doing this business in the first place? And we actually had a year in 2007 where we really, really grew. And we had 48 closings, which for us is a really big, nice. Big deal. Yeah. Like in that 1 year, and we had gone from like two or three closings, you know, 3 or 4 years before that. But you know, it was a good year overall. We made a lot of money. We had a lot of rental properties that were seller financing with small amortizing loans in 12 years that'd be paid off. But we also had a few like this kind of this minority of deals were not good locations, or we underestimated repair costs, or had negative cash flow. And so we sort of came to this decision point for ourselves where we started asking as a partnership, saying, you know, what's the actual end result like in our life that we want this business to do? And both of us, it was kind of funny, we really enjoyed going and playing pickup basketball in the middle of the day over at Little John Coliseum in Clemson with some of the other coaches and people, you know, for like 2 hours just in the middle of the day. That was one of the highlights when we listed all the things that were the highlights of what we really like doing.
Yeah.
That was it. And it's like, well, how much money does it cost to play pickup basketball in the middle of the day? Well, not it doesn't cost anything. But what would keep us from doing that kind of thing and or other things like traveling and some things that I enjoyed or camping or hiking? It was more about the time and the business and what that took away from my time as opposed to just the money. And so money was, you know, this is, I think, the same time I read the 4-Hour Work Week or one of those books about, you know, having multiple currencies in your life. Mm-hmm. And so we started reorienting our business to say, you know, all right, we want to make money with this deal, but how much time and hassle and effort is that going to take? Because that's another bank account. And we want to make sure that that's all going to work out. And so it's been more about finding that balance between those two. And the partnership has helped a lot in that respect, too, because I left for 4 months in 2009 with my wife to go backpacking in South America and Spain and
wow.
lived with families and spoke Spanish and did a lot of stuff that we'd really wanted to do and done some other trips like that since then. You know, having a partner back at home was nice. It wasn't that he was working all the time, but you know, you have another person who can sort of watch after some of the emergencies or that, and you can completely let go while you're gone and know that you have a competent person there who can handle things.
You know, it's really the epitome of why so many people get into real estate investing in the first place is to carve out a lifestyle business for themselves. And some of us forget that. We get in and we're working so hard for the next deal and make the next buck. You forget that one of the reasons you get into this is for the lifestyle. And it sounds like you sort of did a gut check back in 2007 and said, we're doing well, but, you know, well financially. What about well personally?
Exactly.
And we're able to make those tweaks.
Yeah. And it's an aspiration for me, but I'm as guilty as the next person because I'm an entrepreneur and I'm a go-getter. And I think it's part of our culture. And I'm torn about it all the time because we want to grow. We want to do better. We want to challenge ourselves. And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, that's great. That's part of what makes our system work and makes it awesome. But at the same time, like, I think you hit the nail on the head is that, you know, why did we get into this business in the first place? And for many people, you know, if you got into this business because the thing that wakes you up in the morning, the thing that makes your life purpose awesome is that building businesses and making them big, if that's your purpose, then great, go big, make it happen. But what I found from talking to a lot of people and doing some soul searching for myself is at least at certain points in my life, there are things that are non-real estate, non-business that are equally or more important. You know, young kids come to mind and spending time with them and travel and personal growth and even contribution. You know, there's a lot of people out there working jobs, doing things that are like, they're just doing it to make money when they really need to be doing some low paying job that really feeds their soul and contributes to society. You know, I'm thinking of like teachers and mm-hmm. social workers and people who go on mission trips. And I mean, there's a lot of awesome things out there that if you could find a way to produce money from your real estate investments to cover your bottom line and you freed up all of your time from having to work, what do you want to do? I mean, it's wide open. You can do anything. You can make a difference. You can start a nonprofit. You can start another business that's kind of cool. You can spend time with your kids. So I think if we kind of open up our imaginations to what's possible, we've all been so used to working that we think that's the only thing that's going to be fulfilling. And it might be, but when you finally, like, that's one of those mini retirements really did that for me, is I had to like force myself like an addict almost, all right, you will leave your business for 4 months. And it took me like 6 weeks when it literally, like, I was so wound up and tense, and I'm used to making my to-do list and my checklist every day, that I was like 6 weeks in Spain, and we were in this little small town called Cadiz on the coast of Mediterranean coast. It was totally relaxed, totally, I didn't do anything all day. And it was like a knot, like, completely unwound in my chest. And I was like, wow, that's amazing that, there's other things that there's a way of doing things that you were so conditioned to, that until you put yourself outside of that environment, you don't really see the possibilities for other ways to be and to do. And so that's been sort of an experiment for me to force myself to be in an entrepreneurial environment and go get it, make money, build systems, and then purposefully take myself out and look from the outside in to see, is that still what I want to be doing? Is that the right thing? And it's not a perfect equation, but it definitely is kind of a way to get you some perspective on life without waiting 30 years from now to go retirement and then realize that, hey, this retirement sucks. I don't really like this.
Well, I think you said the perfect word. When you get out of your busy environment, the hustle and bustle, for any amount of time, and can step back and gain some perspective on just life and priorities and what's important to you, I'm sure that you then stepping back into your business probably made changes to your business that allowed you to, have more of that lifestyle you're looking for. I'm curious, what does your business look like today? What's an average year for you now that you've kind of taken this journey?
Yeah. Well, I mean, so we have a couple of different pieces of the business. So we have our rental business, and we have approximately 55 units. We're adding a couple right now, so that'll go up some. Nice. But we've got 55 rental units, and, about half of those are college student rentals. The other half are just regular kind of, houses and a couple of mobile homes and things like that for families. And so, so what my weekly, the normal business looks like is I have a part-time bookkeeper, almost, about three-quarters time bookkeeper, who helps me with a lot of the collections and the invoicing and the taking the maintenance calls. And so she's really our kind of our core part of our management structure. So we self-manage our stuff, but we do it all from a virtual system. So I'm in my basement right now with this call, and we have a basement apartment that our business rents out, and we have some filing cabinets there and a computer and most of our stuff's cloud-based, like our management programs. And we have all of our tenants pay either with online or go directly to the bank, like at Walmart, and pay, or send it in the mail and everything. So the point is, it's all really low overhead virtual systems. And we can manage those 55 units really pretty well with that kind of structure without having to get big. Mm-hmm. And then we also, so on the other side of that, my real estate business, we still flip a couple deals a year. And so I still, that could be ramped up if need be, is that we could, I just do 2-3 flips a year just for that extra income and extra savings. And then we also do some lending out of our IRA and do some of those kind of deals. And I'd like to get into that more over the years to participate on deals with other entrepreneurs, but be the lender and the kind of the consultant and the person who helps them put the deal together. And then you make a piece of the pie by being that kind of outside person who's coming into their deal.
Yep. It's so funny how it's such a natural progression that your business has taken. It's similar to mine. It's similar to a lot of guys that I think are sort of our same stage, where you start, with the wholesaling, and you put some money away, and then you start acquiring properties, and you probably do a lot of flips, and then you all of a sudden you built up this IRA, and now you're lending out of the IRA and you're slowing down your flips. It's such a funny life cycle. Yeah. That, I mean, it's very similar to ours. Granted, we still do a lot of flips, although yeah. I'm listening to you kind of envious, like, man, we're humping it so hard over here. It would be nice to scale back at how many flips we do. And
well, I think so. Whenever you're not doing what you're like, when I hear your flips, I say, man, this guy's rocking it. He's doing awesome. And I need to do more flips. And then, but it's like, whatever you're not doing, I think it's the other one sounds better.
but you've got, so you're the stage that you're in, and sort of the life cycle of your business, is now you've accumulated these rentals that are spinning off probably lots of really good passive income. And now you can choose to do 2 to 3 flips a year. Granted, you could choose to do more if you wanted to, but really it's a conscious decision to say, let's just cherry pick the really good ones and
not bust ourselves
too hard.
Yeah, it's kind of a cool, like for the engineers out there, you can sort of engineer your income and your lifestyle, and you can, it's like you turned up a valve, you can turn a valve and turn it on to like turn your income up, or you can turn it down. And I sort of equated it as like, if you kept it really simple and said, all right, on one side of the equation is money, the other side of the equation is like this time and flexibility, is that I've been trying to find that balance between it. I said, I can go out and try to make $300,000 this year by flipping, you know, more houses. But that would also mean that for those 6 months, I can't leave, or I can't take this trip, or I can't do this. And so it's been like, all right, well, but also on the other hand, I have these savings goals, and I want to pay a few more houses off, and I want to do this new deal, or I want to, whatever it is you need money for. And so you can, it's kind of cool when you get these skill sets, is that you can flip houses and turn that volume up when you need it. And I've sort of been in a turn up the volume mode, at least compared to what I was doing 3 or 4 years ago, and doing more flips and selling some of our existing rental properties and doing more consulting. I actually did some consulting and commission work on some bigger deals. And so I've been more in the active income role for the last couple of years.
Yep.
But then my wife and I are looking at 2017, going for a year abroad, either to South America or Spain, and living in an apartment and kind of immersing ourselves there. And so really I'm trying to push it, and then turn the volume back down for that year. And so you can engineer your income, so you still have the rental income coming in, you as a residual effect of all the work you did earlier. And so you can, and when I come back after that year, if I'm like, if I get it out of my system and say I'm ready to go back to work again, then you can turn it back up and start doing it again. And so that rental property income and the income from notes and kind of other kind of passive income sources, they give you that foundational base that they give you enough income to, like, if you have $3,000 or $4,000 a month coming in, you can live really, really well in Argentina, which is a really cool place, or in small towns in Spain. And so we've looked at some of the costs there. And if you make that much money and you have that coming in, you're living just fine, and you're kind of like putting it on hold. But then you still have other wealth building avenues, other places. You know, I'm still paying loans down on rental properties. I probably still have some other stuff that's going to happen while I'm gone. And so it's not like you're putting a hold on your whole life, your whole wealth building life, but you're getting to experience, have your cake and eat it too. You're going to do wealth building, making money, but then you're taking these kind of pauses and then kind of get back into it afterwards.
Man, it's so cool that you're being disciplined, because so many people dream about, man, I'm going to take a year off and do this, or I'm going to travel. And so many people don't do it. And so the fact that you've actually taken the initiative and had the discipline to say, you know what, I don't need to make X amount of dollars this year, I'll take the year off and create memories instead, I think that's amazing. Kudos to you for doing that.
I appreciate that. It's a process, you know. It's not overnight, but I'm trying it, and I'm trying to make it happen. So it's, you know, you have kids too, you know, you kind of look at your little kids and you say, man, these kids are growing up so quickly. And that's what everybody tells you, sort of a cliche, but you know, at least in my case, it's just reminding you have to do it now. You can't wait for these things. Nothing's guaranteed. You know, 5 years from now, you may or may not be here. I mean, you really, if something's important, you've got to make it happen. And that's what it's been about for me.
That's one of the, it's a blessing and a curse to be an entrepreneur. I mean, entrepreneurs are driven, you know, to create and to build. But I think sometimes our faults are we strive so hard to, you know, earn that next paycheck that it's easy to sacrifice that, you know, instead of spending time with family or taking a year off to do this or that. So again, I applaud you, man. I really like the way you've sort of carved out your business in your life.
Appreciate that.
Now, having been in business here for, you've been probably 15 years or so.
Yep, 13 at this point. Yeah, 2003 was my first full year. So.
Okay, so 13 years really being a full-time real estate investor, having bought a lot of deals to hold on to and some to flip. Is there one deal that stands out to you that's your best deal ever?
Well, yeah, I thought about this because I know
what's coming, right?
Yeah, there's a bunch of cool deals. But I think one that's coming to mind for me is last year I bought a triplex. And I think it's cool for a couple reasons. I think your listeners might appreciate it. One reason it was kind of cool was just the way I found the deal. It's just a good lesson that I've been sending letters out, like a lot of people do, to buy houses. And this particular location is in kind of my downtown area of Clemson, sort of off downtown. If you think about any town, any city you're in or town, there's certain areas that are kind of your core. Like, man, that's the really nice place where everybody wants to live or everybody wants to shop. And it's, you know, it's the hardest place to buy properties typically. Mm-hmm. So I haven't bought a lot of those properties, but I've been trying to, you know, get into those. And what I found was that a lot of these properties are, they're owned by families. They never go on the market. You know, you can send all the motivated seller letters you want. And that's really not going to be the, they don't really get motivated because all they have to do is call somebody and somebody else will buy it. You know, it's just been a, and so there's some of these nice quality properties that are kind of tricky to get in the door to buy them. And so I've been sending letters to a gentleman for a long time. And we actually met like 4 or 5 years ago and I made an offer to buy this triplex. And it was, they had been renting them to grad students and was a really nice guy and owned it for a long time. He was just ready to get out of the business. And I made him an offer. The offer wasn't what he wanted. And so we kind of left it at that for a while, but I asked him if I could follow up and he said, sure, that's fine. I followed up, actually made another offer and came up some, you know, like 6 months later. Mm-hmm. It still didn't work. And I hustled hard. I actually went down and met him out of town where he was on vacation or something and presented the offer and tried to kind of present my case on it and why I thought this would need to be the number and not this number. And it still didn't work out. And they sold it to somebody else with the owner financing on a contract for deed.
Oh, man.
And so I was like, man, I lost the deal. I was just kind of kicking myself. Should I come up or not? And but then, you know, it was about a year and a half or two later and a family member calls me back. And unfortunately the person I'd been working with passed away and this person that they financed it to couldn't pay them off. They had a balloon note. And so the family member said, hey, are you still interested? I had to call around town. She called a local attorney or something who knew me and she didn't have my number anymore, but she said, I know there's this guy who made me this offer, my husband offer a long time ago. And so it came back to me and I made the same offer that I did before and they took it and it worked out and I bought the property. And so it's just, I think wow. The first lesson on the deal was just kind of like, it was like a long chase. You know, you really had to stick with it. I mean, years and years and years before this deal came through. But the sincerity and the effort I made early on, I think made a difference because she could have called other investors and I'm sure there's other people who sent them letters all the time. And, but you know, that's that kind of effort that I put in and getting face to face and making, you know, having them know who I am and, you know, it didn't work out and I thought it was a failure, but it ended up being a deal and the deal was really good. I mean, they got a number that made sense for them. And for me, we bought it, you know, it was round numbers around 100 grand. And then this is an area in Clemson where a lot of things were growing and things were happening and rents have been going up for a lot of student rentals and they're building big new student rentals all over town. And so there was a potential to add a lot of value, put money into it and increase the rents from where they had them. And so we put a good bit of money into it, made them really nice and kind of a little bit more luxury kind of apartments and up the rents and are making really, really good income. And so it's just going to be it's a good location. The income's really good. We got stable financing on it, and it's just an all-around solid, good cash flow kind of deal. But I love the story too because I love it's an old building, used to be a lodge for a Lions Club or something, and then I like the fact that this guy owned it for years and years and years, and sort of passed the torch to me, and here I'm taking on this deal, and I don't plan on selling it anytime soon, and maybe I'll pass it to some stubborn, persistent entrepreneur, you know, 4 years.
That's right.
The same thing.
Yeah, you know, a couple lessons there. One, I think you mentioned, I mean, the fact that you were not just persistent, but that you were in person and sincere and they kind of could put a face with a name, not just a postcard. But two, man, follow up is everything in getting deals. I mean, that's we've done a lot more direct mail and it's for off-market deals than we ever have here in the last year or two. And what you find is that it is all in the follow-up. It's rare that you get a deal, you know, in a first pass. But as you continue to hound people, especially somebody that might have shown interest, even if you didn't come to terms on a price.
Right.
And we start pummeling them with offers and follow-ups. Yeah. Most of these people you'll find, they hold on to that. Even if the price isn't right today, they hold on to that. And at some point, there's going to be a situation change. In this case, unfortunately, he passed away, but it was their life changed, and they had your information or knew and could look you back up and said, now we're ready. And the deal came back to you. I mean, I think that's a great lesson in follow-up.
Absolutely. Follow-up is huge. I mean, I just, and you probably found this too, Ken, because you guys do a lot of deals, but especially with these off-market deals, it's all, and even on-market deals, it's not, the deals don't just fall in your lap. I mean, I've rarely found where, I mean, there's a couple, but I rarely found where it's just on the surface, this deal looks great and you just do it. It's typically you're having to work something, you're having to follow up, you're having to negotiate, you're having to, you have to kind of mold it into a deal. It doesn't just happen. You've got to really look at it and work it. And yep. So I think so many people get into it thinking, oh, I'm just going to send some letters out and things, good things are going to happen. And they can, but you've got to be prepared to work your tail off once the deal, once the leads start coming in. And that's only where it begins.
You're exactly right. You know, I feel like the direct mail and the other types of marketing, it gets the phone to ring and it's almost like you've got a nibble on your hook at that point. Mm-hmm. And then it takes a lot of reeling in before you actually close a deal in most cases. Mm-hmm. And follow up, and you might lose the fish and you cast again and get them again. I mean, it's, yeah. It really does require a lot of work and effort to land those really hot deals.
That's right.
Chad, this was awesome, man. This was really, really, really good in terms of just the, I think, lessons that entrepreneurs need to hear about understanding your purpose in life and understanding, you know, it's not all about the money, that it is important to carve out the right lifestyle for yourself. I know you do a lot of blogging on this. Maybe steer people in the direction of how can they get on your newsletter and learn more just in terms of what you're writing.
Yeah, so I have a weekly newsletter, and sort of the theme is what we've been talking about today. I get into a lot of nitty-gritty stuff of real estate and details and deals, but I call it the Business Money Life Project. And so it's kind of a fun way for me. I have a, probably like a lot of you, I have a big bookshelf full of, you know, real estate books and entrepreneur books and self-help books. And I've been reading those, and I'm the guy who circles all the ideas and makes mind maps. And so what I basically do on my blog is share big ideas from about 105 books that I've picked that are really my favorites in those business, money, and life categories. And each week I share a different idea. And so it could be something like last week was about how to use smart leverage in real estate. You know, another article might be how to use mini retirements to take breaks in the middle of your life, which we talked about earlier. And so it's a lot of variety of that kind of stuff. And so if people are interested, you can go to coachcarson.com, and it's a free newsletter. And that's really what I'm all about there, is just trying to get some interesting, helpful information out to people that really, who are entrepreneurs, who are real estate investors, who want to figure out how to do well for themselves, but ultimately make this business be a vehicle that makes their life better. That whatever that means for you, you know, how can you use real estate and business to make you live a better life? And so I would love to connect with anyone who wants to come check me out.
Again, folks, that's coachcarson.com. We're going to put it in the show notes as well if you guys forget. Chad, thanks again for coming on. This is a great interview.
Yeah, it's a pleasure, Ken. I really enjoyed talking to you and look forward to following up.
Talk to you soon. Hey, Deal Farm Podcast listeners, this is Ken Corsini reminding you that the name of this podcast is Deal Farm for a reason, because I want to help you do more real estate deals. If you're looking to buy a deal in a certain market, let me know about it. I've got contacts all around the country. If you're just looking for hard money or private lending, I do a lot of private lending and would be more than happy to work with you. If you're looking to partner on a deal, maybe it's your first deal or second deal and you need a little help, I partner with people all the time. Whatever it is you're looking for to fill in the gap to get started in real estate investing, I can probably help. And if I can't, I'll point you in the right direction. Again, I'm here to help you become successful in real estate. Go to our website, dealfarm.net, onto the Contact Us page. That'll go directly to my inbox. I will reach back out to you, set up a time to talk, and I'll do whatever I can to make you a success. Thanks again for listening to The Deal Farm. We will see you on the next episode. Take care.